This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, and maybe with you if you'd like to call us, 800-462-7413. That's our toll-free number. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Always some interesting research, Zorba. Tell us.
Yes, we're going to talk about sexy music. What does that mean for our teenagers? Very interesting study with a little bit of controversy attached to it.
Okay, the teens love to listen to it.
The teens love to listen to it. Does it do anything? And we're going to talk about, is there a way to grow knee cartilage? Is there a way to essentially improve your knee cartilage, thereby improving your knee and decreasing your pain if you have arthritis?
Knee cartilage is renewable?
We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that.
And we have a MythBuster.
You bet, Tom. And it's a really interesting MythBuster. It'll come at the end of the show. It's great. It's wonderful.
We also have a recipe.
Suzanne's bean and corn salad, and I have to tell you, this salad is wonderful, simple, inexpensive, tasty, and delicious because I have made this salad in variations like this for years. It's a great salad to bring to somebody's house.
So Suzanne didn't invent this salad?
Suzanne did not. Well, she invented her variation of the salad. We'll talk to Suzanne later and see how she came up.
That's Suzanne Hagen from Baldwin, Missouri. She'll be on the phone with us while we do the recipe. Again, 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Sun Valley, Idaho. Hi.
How are you today?
Fine. How can we help?
I have a question, fortunately not about a disease, but about staying healthy and deals with cardiovascular exercise and the intensity levels, especially for the, I'll say, the mature athlete like myself.
You're a mature. How mature are you?
Well, about 65.
About 65 mature.
My question is as far as, you know, controlling heart rate and stuff when you exercise, if you go by the traditional formula of 220 minus your age, and you go, and then your workout range is 65% to 85% somewhere in there, which on me that's about 101 up to 132. But I find out to get a workout that I really feel good about, I'm up around the 140, 145 mark.
You know something? I want to comment a bit about that because it's what you bring up is a very interesting point.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, maximal heart rate is 220 minus your age. It's an interesting, you know, physiological phenomena. You lose about a beat a year. Not a beat a minute.
A beat a year
as you get older. And so we know that you should go, if we look from an aerobic point of view, of aerobic conditioning, and that's not just conditioning. That's only aerobic.
Mm-hmm.
It's 220 minus your age. And so the idea is that if you stay at 80% of your maximal heart rate for 20 minutes, you'll get aerobic fitness. Now, from a point of view of physical fitness, aerobic fitness, that counts. But when we look at fitness, it's balance, it's strength, and it's aerobics. It's really all three. It's a triad, which is important. But if you're comfortable going above that, it may be that your heart goes above that. These are charts. They're made up. And you can go to 90% or 95% of your heart rate, and if you're comfortable and you're an athlete, I don't care if you're 35, 25, 55, or 85, go for it. And as long as you don't have heart disease, that's great. And frankly, I was talking to my daughter the other day, and it was interesting. I said, you know, because I had a birthday, and she said, you know, what's middle age? And I said, well, middle age used to be 30 to 50. That was middle age because people basically died at 65.
Mm-hmm.
And middle age, by many people, is now constructed. It's about 35 to about 75. It really has moved up to that. So, you know, you're at the end of that from some people's view. So you feel good at this rate?
Yeah,
this heart rate?
I run with a, well, or cycle right now. I mean, cycle with a heart monitor. And
uh-huh.
I don't feel any different when it's running 110 than it does when it's 140. And, you know, the other thing that makes me feel good is my recovery rate. I can go from 130, a minute later I'm down below 100.
You actually hit another important point, the recovery weight. There was an article that came out in the Journal of the AMA about a month ago, well, it's actually about 6 weeks ago, that looked at recovery rates and the fact that the recovery rate after exercise may be more demonstrative of how healthy somebody is versus what their maximal heart rate is when they're optimally exercised. So a quick recovery implies a great heart. So keep up the good work that is reserved.
Are you looking for exercises to do at your age?
Nope, I have plenty in between cycling and running and stuff. And I like your comment on there that, you know, I'm on no prescription drug. Blood pressure has been 125 over 78 for about 40 years, and my resting pulse is about 48, so I think I'm there.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate the call. Thank you.
Anyway, thank you, sir.
Yeah, you had another birthday, huh?
I had another birthday. That's right. Appreciate the call.
You're getting up there.
I had another birthday. You're getting I'm 39. I'm 39. That's exactly
Jack Benny stole that.
I'm
you can't
39.
Use it. You can't
Jack
use
Benny's
it.
Jack Benny's dead. I can be 39 for as long as I want to. Jack Benny is now in the... Oh, he's not. He's no longer copyrighted, so I can do that.
That copyright
My kids
ran
don't
out.
Know about Jack Benny. I'm 39.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. To New York City we go. Hi.
Hey, guys. Love the show. Good information, good laugh, too.
Thanks a lot. How can we help you?
Well, I want to ask a question about my mom. Mm-hmm. She's 85.
Yep.
She's had some heart problems in the past, regular heartbeat, prolapsed mitral valve. They were even thinking of doing an implant of, I guess, a pacemaker one time, but she's feeling much better now. Luckily, she's not having too many problems these days and feeling much better, and I've been suggesting to her, well, try doing a little bit of walking, you know, maybe try to get a little bit of exercise. She does housework, you know, she goes to church and shopping, but I think that it would be good if she walked maybe a block or two. And she said, well, before I do that, let me ask my doctor. And the doctor said, no, I don't really want you to do that. And I'm saying to myself, gee, how is she going to strengthen her heart if she doesn't get just a little bit of exercise? No, not a lot, just maybe try one block, two blocks, see how she feels, you know? But she's hesitant to do it because her doctor says, no. I'm wondering if she were male or maybe if her doctor were younger, perhaps she would be told to exercise. I wonder if older women are always told, no, you got to stay in the rocking chair, you know?
You hit a major point there, and everything you just said is right on the money. You know, the idea of not exercising when you're older or not having, you should exercise throughout the life space. Unless you have severe congestive heart failure where you're short of breath when you get up to the chair and walk to the television and turn it off. And even people like that benefit from exercise. You hit it right on the head. And the doctor is absolutely wrong. And the idea that if she went to a younger doctor, she may get different advice is absolutely correct. It may be just if she goes to a different doctor. I mean, the idea that she should not exercise makes no sense at all. That is totally goofy because exercise is always beneficial. The issue is what is the appropriate exercise, and that's what it is. Now, does she have trouble walking?
Not too much. The other day she went with my father to a store, and she felt a little tired walking through the store from the parking lot, and it was a hot day also, through the parking lot, through the front door, through the aisles. I said, well, gee, I think it's because you haven't been walking for several months since you've been feeling sick. You have to get that strength back.
Absolutely, 100% on the money. You can take over and be the doctor on this show. That's exactly it.
And you give me the MD, right?
And that's we'll just trade places. That's okay. I'll be in New York. You'll be in Wisconsin. You'll love it here in the winter. Let me tell you, we've got winters to die for in Wisconsin. But going back to this issue, it is right. If she walks, what you do is you walk with her, and she walks a block, and then she walks a block and a half, and then she walks two blocks. And the way to get her into an exercise program is to, number one, call up a physical therapist. That's one way to, if you're worried about whether or not she's stable, physical therapists can figure that out. But your local senior center has information because senior centers have federal money and state money all over the place, and they have information on where she can exercise safely. And that's the issue, because what you want her to be able to do is to walk and not collapse.
If
she's too weak, it's one issue, and that's where a physical therapist can do it or any kind of a trainer can do it. But she does. The reality is she should be doing something 10 to 20 minutes a day every single day for the rest of her life. She will have more energy, more vitality, more vim and vigor and feel better. And the other thing is she should switch doctors. If her doctor said, I don't want her to walk, you ought to call him up and talk to him, and you ought to do an evaluation of whether or not this is the right doctor. How long has she been going to this doctor?
Like 20 years. They've gotten older together, I guess.
The reality is this might be the right doctor for her, and it might not be the right doctor. I wouldn't just switch willy-nilly, but the reality is I talk to that doctor and say, is this the right one? And it might be. I cannot imagine a physician saying, no, I don't want you to walk. Unless there's an issue with walking instability and an issue with heart failure.
Well, she's like 100 pounds, but as I said, up until a few months ago, she was walking fine.
Absolutely. Question the doctor. Get her walking.
That's great. I appreciate the info.
Come to Wisconsin. You can take over the show.
Yeah, thanks. We appreciate the call. But I want the name of that doctor. I'm getting older. My doctor is exercise. I want a doctor that'll tell me to sit on my butt and quit doing all that exercise.
Couch Potato Tom.
I want to find the name of that
doctor. The new non-exercise
program.
I'll
fly to New York.
The Couch Potato Tom.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, switching age groups here, what's that research on sexy music and teen sex?
It's a great study. You know, I love studies because some studies
are... I hit a note of sarcasm.
So well done. And other studies are so not well done and then are picked up by the media and talked about as if they were truth.
Yeah.
So here's what the study showed. Kids who listen to music with sexy lyrics, have sex sooner. And they draw the conclusion, therefore,
we need to keep
sexy
kids away from
lyrics
that sexy,
cause sex.
Keep the kids away from that sexy music.
Right. So that means in societies where there are no sexy lyrics, there's no sex, right?
No teens.
Yeah, right. As soon as they're 20, there's sex because they're no teens, right? So no sexy lyrics, therefore, there won't be any sex. Yeah. There won't be any sexual fantasies.
I'm sure the sexy music is the only variable involved in these teens.
What they discovered was that 51% of the heavy listeners to sexy lyrics were likely to have sex within 2 years versus 29% of those who didn't listen to the sexy lyrics. Now, of course, they never bothered to figure out whether or not kids who listen to music that has sexy lyrics are more likely to have sex because this is part of whatever they're developing as, as a child and having sex at a younger age.
How about the rest of their lifestyle? What else is going on in their life?
Right. Yeah. What about other stuff that's going on? You know, and this idea that the lyrics produce the act is, in some circles, not controversial because some circles it's taken as absolutely true that these sexy lyrics produce it. And they don't bother to look at the whole milieu, the whole environment. If we look at teen sex, and especially young teen sex, it's the home environment. It's whether or not there's any alcohol involved. It's what the parents teach the children and work with the children. It's what the parents do and knowing where your child is in the evening, who they're going out with, whether or not they're going out with the right kids or the other right kids. These are issues that count. I mean, premature sex at a teenage counts, but it's really the parental issues and the social issues. The lyrics may be only one part of that, and they're clearly there. But I do not believe that there's any proof that there's cause and effect between the lyrics. The lyrics may just be a marker for other issues that are going on in a teen's life that make it more likely that they're going to have earlier sex, which, of course, earlier sex is not good for teenagers.
Teenagers who
have sex at an early age are not good, but I think the lyrics are just a marker for other issues that are going on. I don't think there's any cause and effect.
So we shouldn't control lyrics.
I think we have to parent properly with our children, and that's an issue. And as a parent, if you feel that your children should be listening to some things versus something else, I think you have to discuss it with them and discuss that, just like you discuss where they're looking on the net, just like you discuss what magazines you have in the house, just like you discuss children. It's that whole environment with kids. It's not just the lyrics taken out as a separate issue. And this dumb study seems to imply that it's the sexiness of the lyrics that do it, and obviously they want to get rid of sexy lyrics because that's what causes teen sex, and that is
I'll do it too
dumb and stupid.
800-462-7413. And a listener now in West Lafayette, Indiana. Hi
Zorba and Tom,
how can we help?
I'm calling to see if you can help me understand why I have this strange thing wrong with me. I'm allergic to the cold and I break out in hives whenever I get cold. And I treat it with Allegra, but I don't understand why my body does that. And is it genetic?
You must have a tough winter every year, huh?
I do.
Yeah.
Hard to go skiing.
Yeah.
It's hard to go skiing because you itch from the hives. Well, you have cold weather hives. It's not an allergy. It is a response of the same system that produces allergies. In other words, that same system that produces hives for an allergy produces what you have.
She isn't alone with this problem.
No, not at all. And it is a problem. It's called cold weather hives. And some people get it and some people do not get it. And it can be a problem. And for a lot of people, it will go away over time. How long have you had this?
It started as soon as I hit puberty, so that was 25 years ago.
Gosh, well, for some people it doesn't go away, and I'm afraid you're one of those people.
Oh, great.
Believe it or not, when you become old and feeble, where your immune system isn't working as well, this will go away.
Oh, so, good.
Yay.
So this, yay!
I want to get old and feeble.
I won't have the old weather hives. Gee, ever since I got into the nursing home and I feel cold all the time, the hives have disappeared and it's 85 degrees and I'm wearing a sweater. Getting back to your issue,
yes,
which are cold weather hives, the treatment is taking a non-sedating antihistamine such as Allegra or over-the-counter Claritin, which is cheap. Sometimes you need to take a drug called Singular, which is a drug that stops what's called mast cell activation, which are part of the immune system. That's part of the thing that produces the hives. Some people need to be on steroids intermittently, and there is no cure. It is a chronic problem. You could think of it as an allergy to the cold. It's not. It's that the same system that causes allergies causes this reaction. 95%, maybe 99% of the people, it's intermittent and goes away. And unfortunately, you're not that. Now, I do have a suggestion. If you move to a tropical country such as Panama, you will not have cold weather hives.
Hey, I lived in Florida when I first started breaking out in hives.
No. Florida's 20, you know, it's 20 degrees north of the equator,
yep,
something like that.
You
have to go
too far north.
I got to go through the equator.
You've
okay.
got to go to Panama where it's hot and sultry 99% of the time, and then you won't have it. But you will have it when you walk into air-conditioned places, so you actually don't get rid of it. And that's the problem.
But these medicines you mentioned, they will control this.
Well, they control it intermittently. Do they work for you when you take Allegra? Does that work?
Yes, it
helps.
And also, is that why my nose runs when I get cold as well?
It's part of that same syndrome. It's part of that. Now, the nose running, you can take a nasal spray called Atrovent, A-T-R-O-V-E-N-T, once a day or twice a day. It comes in two strengths, A-T-R-O-V-E-N-T, Atrovent. It's a prescription spray, and that'll help with the runny nose for a lot of people. Do you get it when you chew, when you masticate, when you're eating food? Do you sweat?
Typically, unless it's hot peppers, but
because some people then also sweat when they eat, they sweat and they develop a sweat reaction. So,
is it genetic?
Well, it can be. It's just like allergies, and it's an immune system problem. So, yeah. How many kids do you have? Six.
I have three children, but I have lots of siblings, and I
does anyone else have it?
Nobody else has it but me.
How about your kids? You're adopted. How about your kids?
Yeah.
Do they have it?
When they have something else wrong with them, they break out in hives.
Oh, well, there it is.
If they have a runny nose or...
Yeah, see, they break out in hives. Mm-hmm. They've inherited one of your interesting traits, we call it. We call this an interesting trait.
Right.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thanks. Can you say masticate on public radio?
I think you can say masticate. Wait a minute. You can't say it. Yeah, you can say it on shock radio, and you can say masticate on public radio. It's a politically correct word, masticate. Just don't say it too often and too quickly.
Okay. Let's take a question from our Zorba Pastor on your health inbox before the break. This one comes to us from Norman, Oklahoma listener Andrew Swanson. Andrew writes, a few days ago I decided to quit caffeine and smoking because I started listening to public radio. Since then, I've been having headaches. I was expecting some from the caffeine, but I've been having them all day long since I quit. A couple of aspirin easily relieves them, but how long should I expect these headaches to last? I don't want to keep taking aspirin all day long.
Well, the headaches seriously are from nicotine withdrawal and caffeine withdrawal, and
they
can last for 2 to 4 weeks. Couple suggestions. First of all, the drug that I like that's over-the-counter is migraine. It's Excedrin Migraine. I love it because it's a combination of aspirin and acetaminophen, which is Tylenol.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's great. I would use that for the headaches. You can get rid of the headaches to some extent. It's the caffeine that tends to do it by having a little bit of caffeine every day for about a few days, you know, taper yourself off. If you are a high caffeine user, you're drinking 4 to 6 cups of really good coffee a day like I do. If you stop, you may get a headache and it lasts for a while. But eventually, the headaches do go away.
Yeah. It's not a headache to send us your comments, tips, and questions. Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a listener-supplied recipe coming up. This one from a listener in Baldwin, Missouri, which Zorba says is really, really good.
Oh, it's great. It's
so
great.
Stay tuned for that and more of your calls coming up, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Do you have a question for Zorba? Here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. Zorba, I'm sure, will be able to help you out. But Zorba, before our next call, we have what you say is a great recipe, and I take your word for that. It comes from Baldwin, Missouri listener Suzanne Hagen, who is on the phone with us now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi there.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
We're both great, and we really appreciate the submission of the recipe, for Suzanne's bean and corn salad. Now, you're taking a lot of credit putting your name in the name of the recipe here.
Well, I did a lot of research, you understand. You know, you read enough recipes over time, and then you add your own touches, so golly, got to take the credit.
And you say this is the perfect dish to bring to a picnic.
It is, and it's a perfect dish, period, because it's my kind of cooking, because there ain't no cooking involved.
Absolutely.
You know, it would be my kind of cooking, too, if you also didn't have to do any shopping.
Well, the good part about this is that several items come from your pantry.
Absolutely.
You can get them and stock them up and wait till you need them.
Well, Zorba and I are going to run through the recipe, and you feel free to join in as we go along, okay?
I will.
And Suzanne, I have to tell you something. I have had this recipe for about 10 years, but not from you. And I've got to tell you, because when I looked at this recipe, and you added some variation that I really like. I was whitewater rafting in Idaho. Wonderful whitewater rafting on the Middle Fork of the of the Salmon River with a wonderful group
and
of
canyons.
And on
the raft you were putting this recipe together?
On this canyon strip. That was the name of the group called Canyons.
All
They're
right.
a wonderful, wonderful whitewater rafting group. I have to give them a plug. I just love them. They serve great food. And they served this salad, a variation of this salad, and then I sort of took it out, and I have been making this for 10 years when I go to picnics and other places. I love this salad. It's great. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. It's stuff in your pantry, and people always love it.
So you're going to want to rename this to Zorba.
No, it's Suzanne. She's got her name on it. But I just want to tell you, I love this salad.
Okay, well, let's do it.
And I'll tell you my variations as we do. So start out with one can of garbanzo beans.
Can of garbanzo beans.
That's right.
Right. They're also called chickpeas.
And chickpeas. Can of black beans.
Can of black beans.
Now, do you rinse the beans?
I absolutely do. I want to get rid of those indigestible sugars.
That's
because
right.
I don't want musical bean salad.
No, you don't want musical. Now, that is very true. When you rinse them, you're less likely to have gas.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if not, the sugars that are around there, then that's exactly right. It's the carbohydrate that is in there, that's in the bean can, that's part of the processing. The bean has that sort of stickiness to it. And when you rinse it, it has a crisper, a lighter sort of a taste to it. So I think it's right to throw these in the colander and rinse them with some cold water. So you use a can of shoe peg corn. What's shoe peg corn?
Yeah, what's shoe peg corn?
Well, now you're asking something I really don't know, except to tell you that the texture is very crisp and crunchy.
Absolutely.
And it's not at all mushy like a creamed corn would be.
Right. And that actually, I made that. I look there, and there are certain brands that I use that are vacuum packed, and it says it on there. And the shoe peg corn is a crisper corn.
Is it like dried corn?
No, it's not dried corn. It's just a crisper corn.
It's canned corn, but it's not mushy.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. If you wanted to do work, which this salad is a no work salad, and I would never want to do work, if you used frozen corn that you cook slightly, it would probably be good. But that's too much work. The idea behind the salad is you open up the cans.
Okay.
Then here's the work. Half a red pepper, half a yellow pepper, half an orange pepper. If you have a green pepper, I'd use half a green pepper. It's all a function of how much you want to spend on those peppers, because they're the only expensive thing.
And you cut them up, of course. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You dice scallions, four scallions diced, huh? Or sliced. Which one?
Yes. I just slice them into tiny pieces. I don't care for red onions and things like that. They're
right.
too strong for me, so I like the green onions.
See, now that's very interesting. Now, I like red onion because I like that bite. So
yeah, I
use in it some red onion, and that'll give it a little bit more bite. But you bring up a really good point. The onion is the variable in the salad for people, and the onion for some people will make it too bright for them and too oniony, and so a scallion will give it that taste and less oniony.
Mm-hmm.
Half a cup of diced cilantro.
Half a cup of diced cilantro.
Yeah, do you always use cilantro? Do you always use it?
I always do. I'm a cilantro junkie.
Right, and there are cilantro junkies and cilantro haters.
Yes.
And as you know, so you can leave the cilantro out if you don't like it. And in that case, I use parsley. You know,
that
that's
would
what
work
I use.
Too.
Parsley
sure.
would work with this. And then use half a cup of low-fat vinaigrette dressing.
Half a cup of low-fat vinaigrette dressing.
And some sugar or honey. Now, I've never put sugar or honey in there.
Well, I'm a sugar junkie,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, see, now I've never put sugar or honey. I like that. I use, instead of low-fat vinaigrette, all I do is I pour extra virgin olive oil. I buy it on the net now through, I used a variety of companies, found a company I really like, and I just put a little extra virgin olive oil. Some people also will put lime juice in this, which would be kind of a nice variation. And
that
sometimes
would.
Little sliced limes on the surface will also give it a little bright variation. I'm going to try the honey. Just a little dab of honey would be kind of neat. And you say sugar. It's very interesting. I bet a teaspoon of maple syrup would add a very interesting taste to this.
Sure, that, any kind of syrup. And the vinaigrette I like to use is a dried tomato, or sun-dried tomato vinaigrette that's made by, can I say this, Paul Newman?
Absolutely. Well, sure. You can say anything you want. We love Paul Newman. He's a great
right,
guy.
Well,
we
got to
have him on the show.
And him, too. He's kind of cute. So.
He's kind of cute. In a large bowl, combine the ingredients. As we said, rinse those beans. Rinse them. You won't have as much gas if you rinse the beans, and also it tastes better. Mix it very gently. Store it. You can store it in the refrigerator overnight. I generally make it that day because I think the beans tend to mush up a little bit overnight, but you can serve slightly chilled or at room temperature. It's great. This is a great pass dish recipe at picnics because, remember, there's no mayo.
Right.
And people love this recipe. Yeah. This serves a lot of people.
Obviously not a main dish. What do you serve it with, Suzanne?
Well, if you're not going on a picnic, one time I had an open house and I served it with hoagie-type sandwiches, gyro-type sandwiches that you cut
subs.
Up.
Mm-hmm.
And also it goes well with Mexican dishes like enchiladas, unless you're serving a bean enchilada, which you wouldn't want to duplicate the beans. But, you know, a chicken enchilada would be great with it.
Be fabulous. Mm. And this goes with everything. My daughter made this the other day at a potluck. She's in medical school, at a potluck medical school party. Mm-hmm. Then she came over to make dinner at my house at a wonderful chicken dish stuffed with goat cheese, and she brought this over and put a little dollop, she took a ice cream scoop and put an ice cream scoop worth on each plate, which looked pretty because it was open. I think presentation is really important with food,
right.
And it had that little cup to it, and she put that little ice cream scoop, so that was really cool. I love it. Great recipe. Thank
and,
you
and
so much for sharing.
And the next time you use it, Zorba, you will remember.
I'm calling it Suzanne's Bean and Corn Salad.
That's
well, now
exactly
I'll have
right.
to tell everybody that I didn't make it up, that it's really Zorba's.
No, you did make it up. You did make it up. Absolutely. It's that they heard about it on the Middle Fork of the Salmon River, and they pilfered it from you. And that's how it came to me.
Thanks
three generations away. Right.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you so much.
For sending us this winning recipe, Suzanne, of course, gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
For today's recipe, send a stamped, self-addressed, business-sized envelope to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, our zip 53706.
Or come to our website at ZorbaPastor.org.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And let's see if we can help a listener now, Zorba, in Columbus, Georgia. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Pastor and Tom. How you doing?
We're fine. How can we help you?
One thing you can't help me with, and that's my age. I'm 64, but I didn't realize 64, getting older, would be so painful. But I've been having problems with gout.
Mm.
It's extremely painful. I've tried to change my diet to help, not eating shellfish, organ meats, that sort of thing, but I'm looking for a lifestyle change maybe that might help. I drink black cherry juice every day. That seems to help. Are there certain foods or certain things I can do that would?
Now, are you on medication allopurinol?
I'm on allopurinol, 300 milligrams a day.
Mm-hmm.
And when I have an attack, I'll take colchicine, but that makes me so sick.
Yeah, colchicine. Have you taken Indocin or naproxen for an attack at all?
I have not taken Indocin.
Okay.
I have not. I've been given prednisone.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But I was told there's a subset of people that it doesn't help, and I don't. It's like taking an aspirin. For me, it doesn't do anything.
Well, I've got some distinct suggestions. It's the interesting thing about gout is that people think it's an old disease. You know, gout, and they think about King Louis XIV and Benjamin Franklin and all the old rich people who seem to get gout, not realizing that people who weren't rich also got gout all the time. And we associate gout with rich foods like eating lots of shrimp and lobster and shellfish.
We didn't hear about Phil who had the gout or Jimmy.
And in fact, we don't talk about the non-rich foods like bacon and turkey that are also filled with purines that can also produce gout. And gout is a problem with metabolism in that you produce too much uric acid. There's a drug, allopurinol, which is used 300 milligrams a day. Your doctor can go up to 600 milligrams a day, which I would recommend. Not many people go up to that, but I would recommend that. That's the first step. Number two, there may be a medication that's coming out in the future that'll lower that uric acid more, because the uric acid is the problem. Right now, it's not available. There are some medications that are in the pipeline from a drug company, but it's not in the pipeline now. But one of the things you can do that I would recommend is naproxen. Now, naproxen is over-the-counter under the name brand Aleve and under a bunch of generic brands, too. And I would recommend that you take two naproxen, two Aleve tablets, generic, twice a day. Don't, and you can take it during the bad attacks with the colchicine, but I would just take it twice a day automatically.
All
and
right.
you may keep down the inflammation. In other words, you may not have as many attacks. And what we do is this is using the anti-inflammatory to reduce that inflammation. So my third suggestion is there's an old drug called probenecid, P-R-O-B-E-N-E-C-I-D, probenecid. And that helps the excretion of uric acid. And if you add that to an increased dose of this other drug, allopurinol, you may get the uric acid out of your body. The problem
is
with gout
is... Is that an over-the-counter drug?
No, it's not. It's prescription. So what you got to do is this. Call your doc and say, I want to try double the dose of this allopurinol. That's what I would do first. And say, and then you go and you get naproxen, Aleve, two tablets twice a day, and do that for a couple of months.
Right.
And if that fails, then you ask for this other drug, because you've got to get some uric acid out of your body.
Exactly.
And one way is to do it. But you've got to also take naproxen twice a day. It's a good drug, and it helps keep down a lot of gout attacks with people. And an attack every 6 weeks is awful.
Yeah. You mentioned diet. I always associate gout with drinking a lot of beer.
Well, alcohol is also... No, but that's true. Alcohol,
I don't drink any alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol increases it. Aspirin increases it. That's exactly right. And you want to know which state is number one for gout prescriptions in the country?
Yes.
Wisconsin. Wisconsin is number one or number two all the time for gout prescriptions. Yeah. So we have a lot of gout in our state.
Why would that
we don't eat a lot of shellfish. I think it's because we drink a lot of beer. Tom hits it. I think it's the beer. Although when you look from an alcohol consumption, there are other states, and it might be beer, but it's alcohol. But nobody knows why. Is it genetic? Or maybe people in Wisconsin just like gout. They hanker to it.
So,
you let us know. Call us back in a couple months.
Well,
let us know what
happened. I will definitely.
No, really. You call us. I'd like to hear
about doubling the prescription.
That's what you do. Double the prescription and take your naproxen, and good luck.
And thank you very much for the call.
I do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I have a friend, Zorba, who has gout and drinks a lot of beer.
Mm-hmm.
And do you suppose because of the gout he's stopped drinking a lot of beer?
I would guess no, Tom.
he had that choice to make.
Gout, beer.
Beer and gout?
There we go.
No beer, no gout.
That's right.
Beer and gout went
That's
out.
That's right.
On that one, anyway. Not long ago, Zorba, we had a caller on wondering about the difference between club soda and seltzer. I think I jumped in before the caller was even finished and said they were the same thing. I think you may have agreed. Well, we had a few listeners who disagree with us. Our listeners claim that club soda is carbonated water with added sodium, And that can be a big difference to people monitoring their salt intake.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And one of our listeners passed along this stump the doc question for you, Zorba. Common names for soda vary all the time. Sometimes it's called cola or soda or pop. Do you know what they call cola beverages just north of Boston?
Now, I've been to Boston several times. I love Boston. I've got a good friend in Boston, and he happens to drink pop all the time. And that's what he calls it, but he's from Chicago. So the answer is no. I have no idea what. So you stumped me. Tell me, what is
it? Well, the listener did, and the answer is tonics.
Tonic? Now, I think of tonic as like gin and tonic or tonic water, and that's kind of a bitter taste.
Well, also,
you mean Coca-Cola is called, soft drinks are called tonics?
Well, apparently just north of Boston. This is a little too. This is a little too specific.
A little. You know, people live there. There are regional differences. Well, clearly, Wisconsin is not part of northern Massachusetts.
We'll have to remind our producer not to order his usual gin and tonic when he's just north of Boston.
That's right. It'll be gin. It'll be gin and Coke.
Well, no matter what you call your soda, we still want to hear from you if you have a question, comment, or tip. Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Well, we have some interesting research coming up. We have a medical myth buster coming up. And lots more of your calls, too. Here on Zorba, Pastor on Your Health, from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, you mentioned research on growing knee cartilage?
That's right. That's right. Knee cartilage is an issue. It's an issue for a young athlete who may injure their knees. It's an issue for an older person whose cartilage doesn't work as well. The meniscus, which is the cushion between our bones and our knee, becomes less supple as we get older, becomes thinner. It's more likely to break, like an inconsequential move can cause it to break, and it causes a lot of pain. And we use lots of complementary and alternative medicine to try to fix it. Glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate supposedly will make your cartilage better, but of course there's no proof that it actually does, but it helps the pain.
But we can't actually make the cartilage grow.
Right now we can't. Now this was, these were stem cells. Stem cells derived from bone marrow. So it's not the controversial embryonic stem cells that we're looking at. These are bone marrow stem cells. They managed to get these stem cells to become something called mesenchymal cells, which are the precursor cells to cartilage. And then they did a double-blind study, double-blind placebo-controlled trial. Half the people had the stem cells, half had their joint, you know, injected with you know, a solution that didn't have the stem cells. And now they're watching over time through MRI scans whether or not the cartilage appears to grow. Now, if it grows, this is a major step forward, and if it doesn't grow, well, then it doesn't work. But that's a problem because once you take the cartilage out, you begin to reduce the cushion, and it makes it more likely you're going to have a total knee replacement.
This would be wonderful if this actually becomes a practical way to help people with knee problems, cartilage problems.
Absolutely would be wonderful if something like this would grow. But in the meantime, because we don't know it, people with knee injuries have to do a few things. They have to get their weight down to a right control. They have to exercise on a regular basis to make sure that their legs get stronger. And it's interesting because glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate for some people do appear to help their joints and make them better. You know, one of the problems is that this is something that, you know, that just occurs over time. 800,000 Americans a year roughly have this particular type of surgery to remove the cartilage.
Yeah. Any idea about the time frame as to when?
Well, these are called phase 2 and phase 3 studies, so they're often 3 to 5 years away. There are injections that occur in the joint that help people with cartilage problems. You can have steroids injected in the joints, and then you can have artificial things that is really an artificial fluid that's injected into the joints. And the problem is these things work work, but they only work on a temporary basis. The steroids may work for a few months, and the artificial lubricant in the joint often has to be injected once or twice a year, or go through a series of three injections. But I think this bone marrow precursor cartilage stuff, if this grows, this would be absolutely great. And in the meantime, take glucosamine chondrate. Make sure that you get your weight under control, exercise on a regular basis, and hope this works.
800-462-7413, the number if you have a question for Zorba. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
What's up?
Well, I'm calling with a peculiar diagnosis. Last week, I went to the doctor with back pain and nausea, and he assumed that I had a kidney stone and did not do a scan at that time and treated me with a painkiller and told me to drink lots of water. So for the next 3 days, I had lots and lots of pain and lots of nausea and woke one morning and thought that I passed the stone because I had lots of pain that moved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then had pain the next 2 days, went under my doctor's direction, went to the emergency room where there was a scan done and no kidney stone. The strange thing is, when talking about this at work, I found out at the same time that a coworker had the same symptoms, also had a scan done, and found no kidney stone. So my question was, I still don't know what exactly was wrong with me, and is there any chance that there's some kind of viral infection that we both could have caught that mimics the symptoms of a kidney stone?
Well, you could have had a kidney stone. The scan can be negative. You can have a renal scan, which is negative, or something called an IVP, which is where a dye is placed in your body, a bit more accurate in some ways because it can pick up small stones that are there, but you could have had a stone and passed it. You know,
okay.
And what happens is you have your kidneys, you have your bladder, and then you have the outside. So the ureter, which is the tube between the kidney and the bladder, is small. The urethra, which is between the bladder and the outside for the male through the penis, for the female, up above the vagina, that area is larger. So stones get caught in the smaller area in that ureter. And generally, stones that are about 3 to 4 millimeters or less will pass. And stones that are bigger have to be taken out, or we have to do the lithoplasty, which is where the sound goes in to try to shatter the stones. But you could have had a little stone and passed it. It may not be there. Sometimes it's if it scrapes along the ureter, it produces a little blood, then you often will see a little blood in the urine. But once it plops into the bladder, unless you strain your urine, you don't know if it's there. So you could have had a stone.
Now, is it possible then after I pass the stone to then continue to have pain for the next 3-4 days?
Yeah, people often do have pain for a few days because they may have had irritation along that area. Now, did you have blood in your urine?
Yes. Yeah, and so did my coworker.
Yeah, you probably had a stone. Mm-hmm. That's what you did. You had a stone. You passed it. The problem is what we do is we usually say strain the urine to find what the stone was made of. Well, the stones are made of calcium 98% of the time or so. 2-3%, they're made of uric acid, in which case a drug called allopurinol might keep those stones from happening. But what happens is it's hard to strain your urine. You have to bring the strainer around. And it's called a hat. It doesn't look like a hat, but it's sort of a large white thing. And who wants to walk around with a strainer that urinated into? It's kind of aesthetically unpleasing. So a lot of people don't do it. Once it gets into the bladder, unless you strain it, you won't feel it because between the bladder and the urethra, it's bigger, and so there's no sensation.
Isn't it a pretty freak coincidence that she and her coworker had kind of the same thing at the same time?
Yeah, it must be something you're eating at the office, guys.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
There's something that you're taking.
Well, thank you.
That's it. You know, you've got to watch out.
How painful was this?
Let's see, on a scale of 1 to 10, I think it was around a 7 or 8. I think from talking with people, there's definitely people who've had it much worse, it sounds like.
Some people,
well,
they say
it's my belief, and I know nothing about this, of course, that men have a lot harder time with the kidney stone than women do as far as pain is concerned.
Oh, no, it's awful. It's awful. It's that it affects men. It affects men, and it affects women. And a lot of women have had babies or have had menstrual cramps, and so they know what bad pain is like, and men are not like that. We could say that they weren't as strong as I'm trying to look for the right word. Now,
well,
strong.
It's a harder passage for
women.
That stone in men than it is for women.
No, not at all. Not in the least. Yeah. But I have to tell you, I've had a kidney stone, and it wasn't that painful. So my stone must have been small, and basically they sort of saw it, and I was lucky, and I passed it. I had some back pain, and it wasn't that bad. But it brings people to the ground. It is awful pain for most people who pass it, and 1% of the population has gotten kidney stones sometime in their life. It's common, so.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call. We really appreciate it. Zorba, time now for our Myth Buster. Today's myth involves an old wives' tale. Can we say, isn't that both sexist and ageist at the same time?
Absolutely sexist and ageist. Keep it up. Old wives' tale
but
is
what's
the proper
what's
word.
What's the alternative to old wives' tale that's neither sexist nor ageist?
New wives' tale.
No. First of all, that doesn't explain it because this is old wives' tale is something that's been going on for a long, long time.
Uh-huh,
new
uh-huh.
wives' tale wouldn't be that.
Yeah, uh-huh,
so what's a good alternative?
Old doctor's tale? I don't
know. No, the old is ageist.
Yeah,
How about long time myth?
How about Mythbuster? It's a myth.
Yeah,
myth.
But yeah, myth. Just myth. Just long time myth.
Myth implies
doesn't
long time.
Doesn't have the panache of old wives' tale, though.
I think
I've got
to
say.
Stick to
anyway,
old wives' tale.
This whatever it is
how about if we call this old wives' tale Buster?
No,
I don't think so.
That's
please,
both sexist
please,
and ageist.
Please go on.
Anyway, Zorba, today's myth about jellyfish can be kind of gross. Can urine be used as a remedy for jellyfish stings? That's something I've always believed to be true.
Yeah, no, that is that's a common myth. I mean, in Wisconsin, we don't have jellyfish, so we don't think about it. But I go down to Florida, and I've heard that. Oh, yeah, you get stung by a jellyfish, urinate on it. And it is a little gross, you know, doing that out. And the answer is whether or not it works, and the answer is no.
Oh, it doesn't work.
It is a myth. It does not work at all. However, wherever that myth started, it's like a lot of other myths, you know, urban myths. It started somewhere. It doesn't do anything. The best, there are many effective things that work for jellyfish, and urine is not one of those things. The most effective...
How did they do the double blind on this?
Yeah, how did they do the double... No, it's not that people urinate on them, but they did, but it doesn't work. What they found was that people had a lot of pain. There are things that you can do, though, for a jellyfish thing. Number one, vinegar. Vinegar is great. And I was in Australia... going to the Barrier Reef, and they have vinegar stands all over because you get stung by a jellyfish. You gently put the vinegar on the jellyfish, gently, because if you push too hard...
On where
the jellyfish stung you.
Yeah.
Because you may have the pneumocysts, these little cysts in there, and if you push on it, you'll pop them open, and you'll have more pain in those stingers. So you take vinegar, you put it in a rag or a cloth, and you put it on top of the area that's stung. That's effective. The other thing that's also effective is rubbing alcohol.
Right.
Rubbing alcohol is also effective. Some people use a 50-50 mixture of vinegar and rubbing alcohol. And the final thing that's effective that also seems to work is plain old baking soda that you can have. But the issue is if you're going to the beach and there are jellyfish around, you should have some vinegar with you with a squirt bottle. And if you have it, use a squirt bottle. You squirt it on it, and you just keep on squirting it for 30 to 40 minutes, and it really is effective. And you know what? It's more aesthetically pleasing than have somebody urinating on your jellyfish arm or wherever it is in your body.
I still want to know how the scientists found out that urine doesn't work.
There we go. Now that we'll find out.
If you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, we'd love to hear from you. Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number, if you'd like to talk with Zorba and have your question answered, is 800-462-7413. A listener in Logan, Utah with us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're fine. What's
good.
Up?
Well, back in November, I had a miscarriage, and I got on some birth control after that. And I started having migraines probably in December.
Mm-hmm.
I had about four migraines, and then I changed to a different kind of birth control, the NuvaRing. And then they stopped. And then I stopped the NuvaRing because I got pregnant. And then I had another migraine because I thought the birth control from before was causing the migraines, but I'm still having migraines.
Well, migraines, first of all, can be brought up by, as you know, many different things, and then they occur randomly. And that's the issue is there's probably more randomness to migraines than anything else. Birth control pills can make migraine headaches worse. Any estrogen-containing birth control pill can do this. So using the NuvaRing versus using a pill or versus using the patch, some women find a difference, and they find one will work versus, you know, the patch may work, the pill may work, the birth control a ring may work, or it may be none of the above actually work and help, you know, and help for migraine headaches. And what you discovered was after you were pregnant that it didn't seem to make much of a difference. What do you take prophylactically for your migraines? Did you ever take a beta blocker?
I don't think so.
Okay.
They just gave me these pills that were very expensive.
Imitrex or one of the other
yes,
pills that are in the class. They are very
expensive. Those did not work because I threw them up.
How many migraines a month do you get?
Maybe one or two. Mm-hmm.
Well, there are drugs that are cheap called beta blockers. And beta blockers come in a variety of forms. The most common, the old one, was called propranolol, P-R-O-P-R-A-N-O-L-O-L. Another one is atenolol. And for many men and many women, they take a beta blocker every day and they get rid of their migraines. And it just doesn't, they don't get their migraine headaches. If not, what I would recommend is I wouldn't throw out these other drugs called triptans. There are about eight drugs now, six or seven or eight drugs in that class. I'd call up your doctor. You get a sample. One may work for you in a lower dose, and for many, that's very effective. But for some, Excedrin migraine, which is a mixture of half Tylenol, half aspirin, can be very effective, especially when taken early on or taking an anti-inflammatory drugs such as naproxen. All those will work. The answer, though, that you're asking about is why was this form of birth control okay before and now it isn't? It can't be answered because we don't know why. Yeah. You know, migraines just tend to come and go. But I keep working on it. And I talked to your doctor about one of the drugs to keep migraines away, such as beta blockers. That might help you.
They also gave me this Midrin.
Mm-hmm. Midrin is an older drug that works for some people for
uh-huh.
migraines.
And so do you think because I'm pregnant, I could have more of them?
I always look at the drug, and I always call up the pharmacist, and I always look it up. So I don't have that in front of me. One of the things I never do with any woman who's pregnant, if she says, I'm on the drug, does this drug affect me? You mm-hmm. always have to look it up in the PDR and see what the class is and whether or not it's been affected or not. So I can't answer the question uh-huh. for Midrin, but you have to call up your pharmacist and ask that.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You
guys have a good day.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Zorba, bye-bye.
A pleasure, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is the reason why you're hearing us right now. And Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark. Hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0920Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.